Morning, everybody, and welcome to the next edition of the Patika Wealth Management Group call series. My name is James Patika, and I'm joined by John Patika Sr., who is our senior portfolio manager on the team, the Patika Wealth Management Group here in Clearwater, Florida. And we have a really great guest speaker for you all today to talk about a topic that's really been dominating the headlines over the past year or so, and that is artificial intelligence. And our guest is Kevin Dineen, who is a chartered financial analyst, and he focuses on the technology and communication services sector and brings more than 20 years of experience covering the tech sector. Before UBS, Kevin was with Jefferies on the software equity research team, and before that was with Citi Investment Research, where he was a senior analyst covering global communications equipment. And we're really happy to have him join us today and share some insights with y'all. And with that, Kevin, I'll welcome you to the call.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you today.
Hey, Kevin. John Sr. here. I thought we'd get right into it. We've got to try to keep it to about a half an hour. So appreciate you doing this call with us. I have two goals today. One is that we might leave with a better understanding of artificial intelligence. And the second is, how do we make money for our clients with AI? Let's start with AI has been around for a long time, it seems. You know, even pre-COVID, I can remember we were talking about machine learning, deep learning, things that seemed pretty far down the road, but boom, here it is. What happened, Kevin?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. So we're living in an age of generative AI, which, you know, as you point out, artificial intelligence, broadly speaking, has been around with us for a long time. I call it an overnight sensation, decades in the making. It goes back to, you know, the 50s or the 60s when the first AI conference was convened by an MIT professor. I think, though, the why now, like, why are we having this moment? I think it's the confluence of a few things. So if you think about sort of the raw materials for artificial intelligence, you can put it into sort of three buckets. It's the cost of computing power. It's the cost of moving data around networks and the internet, and it's the cost of storing that data. And I would argue that all of those costs are essentially next to free. And that sounds a little ridiculous, I know, when you think about a $600 billion semiconductor market. But my point is, if you were to sort of scale the semiconductor industry by the amount of computing power it delivers, each year, that just gets excessively cheaper. And the incremental cost, the marginal cost of computing has dropped to essentially zero. The cost of moving traffic around the internet declines by about 35% per year, every single year. The cost of storing data in a data center goes down by about 22% per year. So those raw material costs, I think, really have gotten to the point where they're not sort of a boundary or a hindrance to AI investment. I think the next thing was that the ChatGPT algorithm, the GPT, the generative pre-trained transformer algorithm, I think that was a real breakthrough. And I think that sort of, if you think about what ChatGPT is and large language models, they're really the latest in a family of AI technology called natural language processing. And the GPT, the generative pre-trained transformer, really cleared a technical hurdle that I think had prevented NLP from seeing broader adoption. And then I think the third point is it just became part of the zeitgeist. And if you think back to November of 2022, when ChatGPT was made broadly available, it was the first time me, you, anyone on this call, every single CEO, every single chairman of every board of every company had the opportunity to interact with cutting edge AI in a very personal and impactful way. And, you know, John, to your point, we've lived in a world of AI. I call it ambient AI. Every time that you look for something on a search engine or a streaming service recommends something or your social media feed shows you something that you hadn't necessarily thought of, that's AI running in the background. But the key is it's been running in the background. I think with ChatGPT, it was the first time that you could go and interact with it directly. So I think you put those three things together, the raw materials cost, so to speak, essentially hitting a marginal price of zero, the breakthrough of the GPT algorithm, and this ability for the first time in history to interact with cutting edge AI in a very personal way. I think that's what's led us to this moment.
Kevin, I'm going to jump around a little bit, but look, several stocks have gone up a lot. You know, we deal in the market. Are we in a bubble?
No, I would say no. And I'm going to say no, but so let me tackle the no first. I think the history of financial markets shows us three things about bubbles. Always and everywhere, bubbles are driven by a new technology or a new innovation, right? And the easy comparison here is to think about the dot-com era with the rise of the internet. But we can go back, we can think about radio, we can think about the first joint stock company in the 1600s, right, where people could own fractional shares of a business. New innovation, new technology, that causes a lot of excitement. That leads to the second point, a rapid rise in asset values or equity prices, right? We've clearly seen that, John, as he pointed out. But the third point's the key, and this is where the bubble argument breaks down. That rise in equity prices or asset valuation, it's driven by a rapid increase in valuation that cannot be justified by fundamentals. Now, I'm the first one to tell you, valuation and fundamentals, it's a little bit more art than science. But when we look at these companies, we think these are high quality businesses. And we also have to think about most of the valuation, at least half of the gains in these share prices have been driven by a rapid rise in earnings. And furthermore, valuations don't live in a vacuum. What we've seen is not just a rapid rise in earnings, but we've seen an increase in other financial metrics, a key one called ROE, return on equity. I don't want to get too sort of wonky and financial about this, but it's a measure of the quality and efficiency of earnings, and it generally correlates or moves in the same direction as the PE multiple. And when I look at these multiples for the stocks that are often put in the basket of AI winners, I actually think you can justify a lot of these multiples based on fundamentals. So looking at history, we don't think it's a bubble. And then if we put some numbers around it, right now, AI leaders, they're trading in around 30 to 40 times earnings. There's some that we think are actually major AI beneficiaries that are trading as low as mid-teens to 20 times forward earnings. Let's compare that to the dot-com era. In the dot-com era, those stocks were trading, if they had earnings at all, first off, they were trading 50 to 55 times earnings. So significantly higher than where we are today. And I would argue that the quality of those businesses, the quality of those earnings were very low. And the last thing I would say is, I think AI is fundamentally different than the dot-com bubble. First, I think what we're seeing now is the leaders, the stocks that are benefiting the most from AI are actually the incumbents. They're the leaders of AI. And the second thing is they see immediate revenue opportunities in AI. And I would also argue AI opportunities that are incremental to their core business. And I'd also argue that, again, the quality of these businesses. You know, we're talking about major mega cap companies that even without AI, most of them have real businesses that generate real cash flows with healthy margins, and they have healthy balance sheets. In fact, a few of them have AAA balance sheets, which even the U.S. government can't say. I categorically don't think we're in a bubble, but there is a caveat. All of this needs to see fundamentals come through. So one thing that we're watching very carefully is that there are, for some parts of the AI complex, if I could use that phrase, there's pretty elevated expectations for growth in 2025 and 2026. So we're watching that because we think there could be some disappointments in some parts of this AI complex, because what we know is that investment cycles are big, but we also know that they're lumpy. And we also know that ultimately that investment has to be monetized in the form of AI software and service revenues. And we're not seeing a lot of it yet. Now, we think it will come. We do think that this will end up monetizing significantly, but there could be some fits and starts, some bumps along that road. So we're watching that carefully. But the bottom line here is we fundamentally do not think AI is a bubble.
One heads up to the folks listening here. Kevin cannot talk about individual stocks. This call will outlast all these comments that he makes about individual stocks. So he's going to keep the names private, but we'll be glad to share his reports where he does talk about individual stocks. They're available through us. Just let us know. Kevin, I have that ChatGPT, and James has ChatGPT, and we pay $20 a month to get it. It's pretty amazing. How do they monetize one of these large language models? Is $20 a month enough for them to support this?
Probably not. And I would say that the bigger opportunity here is on the business side. So not so much consumer. I think consumer could be a nice business, but I think the bigger opportunity, and I'm not talking about ChatGPT specifically. I want to be clear. I'm talking about generative AI and large language models, right? So not any one company. I'll give you some examples of where we're seeing this be put to work or at least being put through trials. Our base case right now, or our view right now, is that AI and large language models and generative AI, it's really an opportunity to drive productivity and cost savings more so than incremental revenue. There may be some revenue opportunities, but we think the sort of early low-hanging fruit is going to be on the cost side. So one great thing about being at UBS is we're sort of a universal owner. As a firm, we're significant owners of basically every publicly traded company in U.S. exchanges. And that gives me the opportunity to talk to a lot of management teams. So, you know, I spoke to the management team at a major U.S. telecom company. They handle about 4 million customer service interactions every day. They did a pilot program of putting some of those customer service reps on a co-pilot that helps them get information better, that helps them identify problems sooner, that drives better solutions for their customers. They saw a 15 to 20% increase in customer service rep productivity. I spoke to a CIO at a major international bank, and he put some of his programmers on a co-pilot that looks at essentially a repository of information about writing programs. So think of it as like a Wikipedia for programmers. He saw as much as a 35% increase in programmer productivity. I met with the head of business development at a publicly traded software company. This person was in charge of one line of business within an overall portfolio. He did an alpha beta test of a sales co-pilot on about 20 of his sales reps, and he was seeing a 15 to 20% increase in productivity. So I think with numbers like that, I think it's pretty easy to see how this will be monetized. And if you just think about the opportunity, we published a 100-page paper and we did a lot of work in this. And if you think about the average information worker, right, the average office worker, they make about $55,000 a year. So if you can drive, let's even just be conservative, if you can drive a 10% productivity gain, that's $5,500 worth of value. Companies will pay for that sort of productivity. So we think the opportunity is definitely there. We think it's going to be monetized first and foremost through cost savings and productivity gains, not to say that there's not revenue opportunities. We think it's the cost side of the ledger where you're going to see more activity and see the bigger opportunity, at least in the earlier stages.
All right, Kevin. So you said AI is not in a bubble. But obviously, there's got to be some investment risks that you're mindful of and we should be mindful of, like the hype that's driven this up, the technology itself, possible recessions, something. What would keep you up at night if you had all your money invested in AI?
No, it's a great question. So I'll leave macro aside, right? Nobody really pays me to think about macro or opine on macro. And to be honest, I'm not particularly good at it. But, you know, clearly, if there's a recession, I think a lot of investment opportunities, a lot of investment narratives face some headwinds. So we'll just table that one. I would say if we look specifically at the technology, I think it's more about the hype outrunning the reality. And that reality is that this is hard to do. You know, what we're hearing from a lot of companies, both buyers of technology and technology companies that sell this as a product, is companies have a lot of thinking to do. You know, this isn't just sort of like turning on generative AI and getting rid of a whole bunch of people. Generative AI is powerful, but it's not perfect. It has a very high error rate at times. You'll hear it referred to as AI hallucinations. Well, that's like sort of a euphemism for it giving the wrong answer. And there's reasons for that. AI is generative AI is probabilistic. It's not deterministic. It's based on probabilities of words going together. And if you think about particularly the English language, there's a lot of nuance. There's a lot of context. Now, the example I always like to use is if I ask somebody, you know, fill in the blank, I hear the dog 99.9 times, somebody would say bark, and it would be right. But in the English language, bark can have multiple meanings, right? Bark for a dog, bark on a tree, or if you're a barbecue fan, bark on a piece of smoked brisket, right? So context matters, and it's that probability that can trip up generative AI. So I worry a little bit that this is actually harder to put to work, harder to implement, harder to get right. It's not a panacea. I don't think it fundamentally changes the economic model of a business. Like I like to say to people, you know, if you're a bank, fundamentally you borrow short, lend long and take credit risk. AI is not going to change that for you. AI is not going to reinvent your business. It's going to help you do what you do better, maybe more accurately, maybe at a higher level of productivity, maybe at a higher level of risk, maybe at a higher level of efficiency. But it doesn't fundamentally change the fact that you're a bank, you borrow short, lend long, and take credit risk. So we need to be careful about the hype outracing the reality, and we need to be patient for this stuff to actually get deployed, and we need to keep our expectations measured. And I would say, you know, it sort of goes back to what I spoke to earlier, that, you know, we are watching consensus expectations for growth in 25 and 26. We need to see all this investment start to be monetized so that there will be additional investment behind it. And right now, I would say, you know, I gave you some early use cases, some early examples. I would say, I think things are progressing well. We had some companies report, some big technology companies report. They were able to give us a few data points, a few breadcrumbs that sort of point towards AI starting to ramp. But it's the timing and pacing that we have to really be mindful of here.
Kevin, I had an emailed question to me about the thing you mentioned, AI hallucination.
Yeah.
Explain it just a little better. I don't think you need to get deep in, but I hear it more and more now.
Yeah. So an AI hallucination is where a generative AI program gives you the wrong answer. And it goes back to what I said that, you know, John, let's go through an example. If I was to say to you, fill in the blank, I hear the dog, what would you say?
Bark.
Bark, right? 99.9999% of the time, people will use the word bark. I actually had somebody try to be funny and say meow, and I kicked them out of the meeting. But that's an example of word pairs going together with a very high probability. But as I said, bark can mean different things at different times. And that's one root cause of AI hallucinations, which is a euphemism, as I said, for getting it wrong. The other issue is that it goes back to sort of if you took programming in high school, the first thing that you learned was garbage in, garbage out. These AI systems are trained on huge corpuses of text. So ChatGPT was trained on, I think it was 8 terabits of data. It basically pulled down the entire public internet. What does that look like? 40 miles worth of bookshelves. And it took in all this text and it figures out how words go together. But the problem is, just because something probably goes together, if it was given factually wrong information, it's going to give you an incorrect answer. And I think that's what companies are struggling with a little bit right now, that the accuracy levels aren't where they need to be. Think of it, you know, in any business, if you're running a customer service rep operation, getting it right 80% of the time isn't good enough. 90% of the time isn't good enough. You probably need 5 nines of reliability, 99.99, especially if you're going to automate this. So I think these AI hallucinations are a function of, one, it's just a fact of life that this is probabilistic. It's based on probabilities. And secondly, the outputs are only going to be as good as the inputs. The results coming out of any large language model will only be as good as the data that it's been fed. And as we all know, maybe we shouldn't rely on everything that we get off of the internet. So you put it all together, I think that's where we get AI hallucinations.
Thanks. That's a good explanation. Now, AI, basically, you're talking about the government and all these guys worried about it and the adoption of it. Maybe you can touch on what it means for the economy and labor if this works.
Yeah. So I think, first off, I think this is really, it's really important for productivity, right? We live in a world where I think labor demographics are going the wrong way. We have more retirees who are living longer, and we have fewer workers to support them. So productivity is absolutely key. I think a big question around this is if AI, as we expect it will, captures value, creates value, who's going to capture it? Will we see margins get a lot bigger? You know, the margins expand. It's possible, but I'm not sure that anybody's going to absolutely differentiate their business on AI. Because if you look, we've been in sort of a technology-driven world for 20 years, and I'm not sure, other than technology companies, I think if you look industry by industry, I think it's hard to find a business that's successful because of its technology strategy. I think it's also, though, at the same time, I think as AI proliferates, I think it's an open question for what it means for small and medium businesses, because I do think that technology is becoming increasingly a scale game. You need a lot of resources. You need a lot of capital to make this investment in the data centers. You need a lot of capital to train these models and to maintain them. You need resources to hire the right people who are, as you would imagine, scarce supply. And you need a lot of data. I do think this could set up for a world where in any industry that we look at, the big get bigger. I think there's always a fear too, and I think this is where a lot of people are focused. There's always a fear that any new technology is going to put labor out of work. And I would say, you know, if we look back at history, there's sort of this repeating pattern. A new technology is introduced. There's a lot of fear about job losses. And there does tend to be job losses. And I would call it sort of disruption, but ultimately what happens is technology creates a much bigger opportunity for labor. And maybe I can give you a couple of examples of that. 1908 was the year Henry Ford rolled the first Model T off the assembly line. I guarantee you that was a bad year to be in the horse and carriage business. That same year, though, I absolutely guarantee you it was a great year to go into the road building business. It was a great year to start a tire business. It was a great year to start a car dealership. My favorite TV show of all time is Mad Men. And there's a great episode in there where the ad agency takes delivery of an IBM computer, the first IBM mainframe. That sort of kicked off an idea. So I actually went back and I found an article from 1964 in the New York Times talking about the first computers being put into businesses. And they interviewed people who worked in offices, and there was nothing but fear because these machines, they don't get sick. They don't take vacation. They don't go out for lunch. They don't go out for smoke breaks because then everybody smoked. And they worked weekends and they worked nights and they never asked for a raise. But what's happened? In the last 6 years, I would argue it's been an amazing time to be an information worker. Why? Because technology makes productive people more productive. That ends up being net additive to the economy. It ends up being net additive to how labor gets compensated. And I would argue it actually increases aggregate employment because you get faster growth and it probably drives more efficient allocation of labor resources. So there's always going to be concern, but I would tell you, if you look back in history, we've never had a technology that has actually caused a shrinkage of the labor force. It changes the labor force. The jobs of the next 5 years aren't the jobs of the last 5 years, particularly when you think about where the growth will be. But it will cause some disruption, but I think it opens up a lot more opportunities.
Yeah. In your reports, a lot of times you'll talk about different sectors that'll be affected by AI. And one of them is education. I'd like you to touch on. I wrote down one of the sentences. Smartest kids in a room are no longer the kids with all the answers because AI has all the answers. That's kind of made me think. So talk about education and what AI might mean to it, please.
Yeah, you stole my punchline, John, but yeah, I'll expand on it a little bit. And I actually do have some additional
thoughts.
Yeah, I do have some additional thoughts. So, you know, as you said, when we all grew up, the smartest kid in the room was a kid who knew all the answers. But now you have a system, I was going to call it a machine, a system that if it doesn't know the answers, it can certainly get the answers faster than you ever can and has a wider corpus of knowledge that it has been trained on. So what does that mean? Personally, I think this means the revenge of the liberal arts major. So if you think about the last 30 years, like in the 80s and 90s, it was about going into finance. In the 2000s, up to now, it's been about going into STEM and technology in particular. I don't think technology is, I think it's still going to be a great field and lots of opportunities there. But I think in a world where you can get the answers on demand faster than anybody else, I think it's more about asking the right questions. I think it's about critical thinking skills. I think it's about looking at the world in a different way and asking questions about that. Because I think the quality of the questions, especially when you think about our conversation around hallucinations, the quality of the questions will determine the quality of the answers as much as the quality of the inputs, the data that it was trained on. So this is why you hear of a new field called prompt engineering, P-R-O-M-P-T. My New York accent can butcher that word sometimes. But prompt engineering is just learning how to ask AI questions in a way to optimize the answers, the accuracy and the efficiency of the answers. I also think that AI is potentially one of the best things that's happened to the education system in America, which I don't take any delight in saying this, but I think it's fact that the K-12 system in the U.S. stinks. I think we're ranked like 32 out of 34 in industrial developed nations on K-12 rankings. It's not a money problem. We spend a lot on students. I think what AI will do, what generative AI will do, I think it's going to allow for almost customized tutoring, customized education programming. And I think it's particularly interesting when you think about kids who have learning disabilities, kids in special education, which is a significant portion of the population. I've seen stats that suggest it's 15% of the K-12 population, and it consumes a higher level of resources. And I think that because what generative AI can do is it can learn where kids are at, it can learn how kids learn because it iterates so fast, so quickly. I'm actually pretty bullish on what AI could mean for education, what generative AI could mean for education specifically. And I think it's going to require, you know, a different set of skills going forward.
James says we have time for two more questions. One, and it's a little out of your sectors, but can you just comment about the data centers? I'm intrigued by the data centers, the massiveness of them, what they made up of, and how they're going to develop these. Just maybe an observation before we get to the end here.
Yeah, look, I'll be honest with you. I'm a little bit out of my depth here. My colleague and good friend, John Wallachin, covers those, but I can talk a little bit about it from the perspective of some of the issues that the data center industry writ large is facing and what that might mean for the companies I cover. So we're seeing an explosion in data center demand because AI it's a whole new wave. I would actually argue, I think AI is very incremental to overall technology spending rather than cannibalistic. AI tends to be very power hungry. It's very compute intensive. I think we're seeing an explosion in demand for new data center space. And some of the gating factors there are you can't just plop a data center down wherever you'd like. You have to make sure it has access to power. So that's become one of the gating factors. And within that build out of data center demand, you know, there's a whole value chain or supply chain that goes into that. So it's everything from the chips that run these large language models to the data storage, to the data networking, to the myriad of components and cabling, and even electrical power and cooling systems. And we actually, as a team, we published a thematic list that actually attacks this problem and tries to identify companies that participate in the AI value chain in total. So yes, we have a lot of technology exposure in there, but we also have data center exposure. We also have surprisingly some industrial and I believe utility company exposure. So I think there is a whole sort of cross-sector theme that you can tease out of this data center demand. And I think we have a solution to address that.
Yeah, we've got some good stuff on that. Thanks. Hey, last question, and the most important, of course, how do we invest in it? How do my clients make money in this early stage AI?
Yeah, so look, we think this is a very, very significant investment wave. And technology has been, as everybody knows, I think it's been a secular growth category. If you look at software year in, year out has been growing roughly 10% per year. AI probably, we see the potential for AI to grow multiples of that and reach about $1.1 trillion in revenue by 2027. And we're talking about the entire AI ecosystem. So with that said, I think you have to, I'm going to go back to a couple of points. One, as I said, I think the big get bigger. Scale matters. We think this will lead to vertically integrated oligopolies. In other words, companies that own an AI stack from beginning to end, everything from that they design, in some cases make or more often outsource, but it's their own chips in their own data centers, running their own AI models on their own data that they monetize then through their own services. And we think data matters a lot. AI without data is a Ferrari without gasoline. It doesn't do anything. I would actually argue data is probably ultimately more important than the large language model itself. And I would just point you back to the issue of hallucinations as to why I think that. With that as a backdrop, we sort of see three layers within AI, sort of like a layer cake. At the bottom, it's the enabling layer. This is the infrastructure. This is the data centers that we were talking about, all the equipment, all the computing, all the networking, all the storage, the power, the cooling, the utilities, everything that goes into building out the infrastructure. On top of that, or inside of that, you run what we call the intelligence layer. This is where the data lives. This is where the models live. On top of that is the application layer. That's where it ultimately gets monetized directly to the end customer. And we identify companies that participate in each and sometimes end-to-end all three of these layers of this AI stack. And right now, we think you should own or be overweight within this paradigm the infrastructure layer, because we think that's where you have the fastest and most visible growth over the near to intermediate term. So we like some semiconductor companies in there. We like some companies that maybe they don't design their own semiconductors, but they manufacture semis for other people. We like some of the cloud companies. And we do have some exposure to some software companies that we think can start to monetize, because ultimately we think data is what differentiates. So that's the way that we think about it. We think you have to take this sort of value chain approach. Think about this as a layer cake. There's sort of a staging. Infrastructure first, then intelligence, then enabling. And right now, we think you should be sort of more exposed to that enabling layer.
Great. Well, Kevin, that was a great overview. And this is James here on AI and giving us an update on that. And we want to give you a final word here. Do you have any final thoughts for our audience here before we conclude the call?
I'd say a couple. I do a lot of these calls and I do a lot of meetings with clients. I was on the West Coast recently for, I think it was about a week, and I probably met with, guessing, more than 250 clients. And I would say that embrace the opportunity and don't be overly concerned with the fear or the fear mongering. We think AI is a significant development in technology. It will impact, we think, every single sector in the global economy. I think the history of technology shows us that it ultimately ends up being for the good. It ends up being a net job creator. There could be some disruption along the way, but the aggregate opportunity ends up being accretive to economic growth. And from an investment perspective, we think this is where you work with your financial advisor to understand what the right level of exposure for you is. But we do think this is a durable investment theme that has multiple years to run that we think investors do need exposure to. And we leave it to financial advisors who know their clients, understand their clients' objectives and the risks that they're willing to take and can right-size the opportunity for clients.
Well, thank you, Kevin. And we really appreciate you joining us on the call today. And if anyone listening would like to receive any of Kevin's most recent research pieces, please reach out to us and let us know. We're happy to share that with you. And also, the call is being recorded as a podcast on the Pateka Wealth Management Group podcast, which is both on the Apple Podcast Store and Spotify. So please subscribe on those platforms and share with any friends or family you think this information would be valuable to. And with that, we'll end the call and take care, everyone. Have a great weekend. And thank you again, Kevin, for your time.
Thanks, Kevin. Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.